The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session for students to law.
Thank you. All be seated, please. Morning and welcome to our second hearing for February 11, 2026 at the University of Idaho College of Law. We are pleased to welcome so many of you to the room today for this hearing. It is the State of Idaho versus Nicholas James Orr, case number 51866. This matter is brought by Nicholas Orr on appeal, represented by Kira Mai, and the state is represented as respondent by Kiel Gans. Counsel, either of you have preliminary matters to take up for argument?
There.
Well, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. The state charged Mr. Orr with felony witness intimidation based solely on the words he uttered during three phone calls to his wife. The catch-all provision in Idaho Code Section 18-2604, subsection 3, by any manner, criminalizes a substantial amount of protected speech, rendering it facially overbroad. Even if the statute survives facial overbreadth, the court's application of it to Mr. Orr's protected speech infringed on his First Amendment rights, and his conviction should be vacated. Officers responded to Mr. Orr's home after he called 911 on a Sunday morning just before 10 a.m. When officers arrived, they noted physical injuries on both Mr. Orr and his wife, Sky. Mr. Orr's left ear was very red, and he had scratch marks on his bicep, abdomen, and a very prominent scratch mark from his neck down to his chest. Sky's neck was red, and officers observed popped blood vessels in her left eye and lips. Despite the conflicting physical evidence, Mr. Orr was placed under arrest. The next morning, before his first court appearance, Mr. Orr called Sky from the jail, and they discussed the events of the night before, as well as other issues in their relationship. Mr. Orr said that Sky could fix this by talking to his attorney. They discussed financial strain and the fact that Mr. Orr's paychecks would come in the mail, but he wouldn't be able to sign them.
Well, he also repeatedly urged her to go testify at the preliminary hearing, right? You've got to show up at the preliminary hearing. You've got to tell that at the preliminary hearing. I mean, this, what he was urging was more than just her talking to his attorney. He was talking about her testifying in court.
Yes, Your Honor, there was discussions of the arraignment, the preliminary hearing, whether she should show up at that or not.
When was the no contact order in place? Before this call?
The first call, the June 12th call, the no contact order had not yet been served on Mr. Orr. So the no contact order is contained on the disc exhibit. It shows that Mr. Orr was served at 3:36 p.m. This first phone call I'm referencing is from around 11 a.m. It's not super precise, but I believe it is before the no contact order. Mr. Orr even references that he hasn't been informed of a no contact order at that point in time. Again, they discussed custody of their respective children, and Mr. Orr asked Sky if she planned to contact his attorney and if she planned to revise her story. Before I address the facial challenge, I would like to talk about the court's application of it to Mr. Orr's conduct. The statute provides that any person who, by direct or indirect force, any threats to person or property, or by any manner, willfully intimidates, influences, impedes, deters, threatens, harasses, obstructs, or prevents a witness, or any person he believes may be a witness, from testifying freely, fully, and truthfully, is guilty of a felony. If a statute, as applied to a defendant's conduct, infringes on his protected speech, his conviction must be reversed. In State versus Manzanares, this court described an as-applied challenge as being based on the particular facts of a defendant's case. And the first inquiry is essentially what conduct forms the basis for Mr. Orr's conviction. And I think in this record, we have abundant evidence of what the conduct was. This court has those three phone calls. They were admitted into evidence at the preliminary hearing. And additionally, the state's charging document, the information, charges through phone conversations. That's page 39 of the record.
Does the scienter requirement in the statute save it?
No, Your Honor. I don't think so. So there's willfully. That's the main element, mens rea element. However, in 2007, this court's decision in State versus Anderson It addressed a jury instructions issue. However, it also, I think, sort of read into the statute a specific intent requirement that is with the specific intent to prevent the witness from testifying. And so I think in Anderson, I think that raises other challenges. But no, as far as the plain text of the statute, I don't think the willfully is sufficient.
But do we apply the willfully to the verbs that follow it? For example, I mean, it's one thing, willfully intimidates, that sounds pretty bad, right? But willfully influences, or willfully deters, or willfully prevents. Adding the willfully to the verbs, does that not suggest still a rather specific intent?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason for that is willful is just essentially you have to have done an act on purpose. So I think you can do an act that may influence someone or may deter somebody, but did you do that with the specific intent to prevent them from testifying fully and freely? So I think there is a distinction to be made there. And I will address the Anderson case further as well. So again, the fact that we know the conduct that forms the basis for Mr. Orr's conviction means that this court can determine whether it was unconstitutionally applied to him. And first, I want to talk about the two first methods, by direct force, direct or indirect force, or any threats to person or property. We know that those two are not at issue here, really. There's no force because this was a phone call, and we have testimony from the jail deputy at the preliminary hearing who listened to all these phone calls saying, I didn't hear any threats to the victim at all, no indirect threats, no threats of violence. And it's not really, the state doesn't necessarily dispute that these two methods of intimidation, if you will, are not at issue. So really we are under the by any manner prong of this statute. And again, I think tellingly at the close of the preliminary hearing, the state moved to amend its complaint to include that catch-all provision because previously it was charged under only the first two methods. So I want to highlight some of Mr. Orr's protected speech here. And this would be in contrast, really, to the district court's focus on what Mr. Orr did not say on the phone calls. So when he was referring to the jail kiosk use and commissary money to place phone calls, Mr. Orr said, this is all the money I've got for the week, so I'm not going to be able to talk to you much. When they discussed the financial strain on their household, he said, you're going to get my checks, but I don't know how I'm going to sign them. He said, I don't want to go to prison for 5 years. I love you, and I never wanted to divorce you. I need you to try and get this fixed. All of this is protected speech, and all of this forms the basis for Mr. Orr's conviction. So we know that this is...
Well, hold on. Were those words used to convict him, or was it the other things that were said? I feel like we're removing the context from this. You began your presentation here today by saying that he was convicted solely on words from three phone calls with his wife. That may be true, but the context is the wife was a victim, alleged victim of a violent crime. At least two-thirds of the conversations took place after a no-contact order was in place. And the conversations that are at issue in this case involved a pending criminal matter. So when we talk about this fitting within the hubris of protected speech, what's protected about the speech that was focused on by the prosecutor in this case that was used to convict you?
Your Honor, I think that the state's charging document is broad in the sense that it says through phone conversations. And so there wasn't a specific, you know, in the information, this is the wording that we're using. I do take Your Honor's point that they were lengthy phone calls, about 18 minutes
in
length.
If he tells her to make sure that she feeds the dog, I don't think anyone's going to say that's part of this case. But where he's persuading her to change her testimony or to not say anything or to take specific action that will result in him being acquitted or the charges being dropped, isn't that really ground zero in this case, the crux of the case?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think to that point, we can look at the magistrate court's findings on the probable cause determination, where we know that the magistrate court believed that there were implied threats of divorce and financial instability. And so I think by the plain language of the statute, threats to person and property certainly just can't include a threat that you may divorce someone or that you may not be able to support the household if you're in jail.
What about threats of self-harm? It appeared that he was threatening he was going to kill himself.
I take a little bit of issue with that because I think that those statements were sort of said, I agree, they were said in the course of these phone calls, but they were not tethered to a specific, hey, Sky, if you don't do X, I'm going to, you know, harm myself. They were said in sort of an amorphous, he's expressing fear of going to prison, and if I have to go to prison, I would rather not do that. I would maybe rather die. And so I think that, you know, we may not like that speech, but it is protected speech in this context.
What about tell them it didn't happen, you can fix this, and they'll release me on everything at my prelim?
Your Honor, that's certainly a troubling statement. I agree. But I want to focus again on the broad language of the state's charging document, which just charges through phone conversations. And so because any amount of the speech that is protected was forming the basis for this conviction, I do think it's swept in some of his unprotected speech, but there's a whole lot of protected speech that is present in there as well.
Is that a defect in the charging document then? Does the charging document legally have to state specific remarks that it's depending on, or can it just generally refer to the entirety of the conversation?
It can be general, Your Honor. I think that's just a matter of the prosecutor's discretion and how they want to draft a complaint or an information.
So I just want to clarify what you're arguing on appeal, because we're talking a lot about the charging document, we're talking a lot about the magistrate court's findings, which to me would suggest you're arguing whether there was enough evidence to bind him over or not. I didn't understand you to be arguing that on appeal. I understood your appeal to focus on this statute is overbroad in violation of the First Amendment, and if it's not overbroad in violation of the First Amendment, it's overbroad as applied to his conduct here.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm not challenging the bind over directly.
Okay. So when we talk about, when we're having this discussion, is the discussion that you're getting into about his speech part of your as-applied argument or part of your over-breath facial argument?
I bring up the magistrate court's findings because I think it's helpful to inform the as-applied challenge. I don't think they are relevant to the facial challenge to the statute, but I rely on them just to show the breadth of the statute and how the magistrate court's, frankly, very broad reading of the statute supported the bindover. And that's kind of how we get to where we are. And the district court's decision, it didn't explicitly discuss the factual findings of the magistrate court's decision, essentially.
So my struggle with your as-applied argument is, to the extent there was protected speech in these phone calls, I don't see where he's been charged under the statute for that. He's been charged for essentially attempting to persuade her to testify in a certain way at his preliminary hearing, which implicates perjury. So I'm struggling with how the speech that forms the basis for the charge, when we look at your as-applied challenge, is constitutionally protected at all, because speech incidental to criminal conduct is not protected. So the aspects of these phone calls where he is alleged to have been trying to persuade her to testify in a less than truthful way at this preliminary hearing, why isn't that speech incidental to the criminal conduct of perjury, and it wouldn't be entitled to constitutional protection?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's important to remember that this, at this point in time, at least the first phone call, Mr. Orr has no idea what Sky has said or has not said. And so I think it's a very fair reading of what he's saying to say, you know, I'm the one who called the cops, and I'm the one who's ended up in jail, so you need to fix this. And whether that means supplementing your initial statement with additional truthful information, I think that's a very fair reading of these remarks. And that brings me to...
Isn't that a question for the jury, though?
I think that would ultimately be a question for the jury, Your Honor.
And so I'm struggling with how that implicates an unconstitutional as applied issue.
Yes, I think, again, because the phone calls in total are 18 minutes in length, you know, certainly the prosecution chose which statements to admit, which audio portions to admit, and they made no attempt to narrow those to only the speech that may be integral to criminal conduct. And I think...
But under the rules of evidence, don't they have an obligation to introduce enough of the statements to provide the context for them? And then the other thing I would note is we didn't go to trial in this case, right? He opted to plead and reserve his right to appeal. So he could have had every opportunity to make the arguments you're making now before a jury, but he chose not to. And so where it strikes me whether he was intending to intimidate her or convince her to testify less than truthfully, that's a fact question for the jury. It doesn't mean that this statute is unconstitutional as applied to his conduct.
Your Honor, I would push back on that, and I want to talk more about the mens rea element because I think that I understand your points as far as the as-applied challenge goes. I would like to use my remaining time to discuss the facial challenge, and I want to talk more about the mens rea element specifically.
Well, can sorry. I,
that's okay.
Before you get there, my struggle with your facial overbreath challenge is I don't see where you identify. I mean, the whole point of overbreath is the statute sweeps so broadly that it sweeps in a substantial amount of constitutionally protected speech. When I read the intimidating a witness statute, it is specific to efforts to convince a witness who the person expects to testify less than fully, fairly, and truthfully. And so when I read the statute, it's directed entirely at perjury. I almost look at it as an attempt statute because we've got suborning perjury if the person gets on the stand and actually testifies untruthfully. This intimidating a witness is you've attempted and maybe they haven't gotten on the stand. So help me understand, how does this intimidating a witness statute reach anything other than attempting to convince a witness to commit perjury?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the focus is, again, that by any manner, the catch-all provision. We have, again, Mr. Orr concedes that by direct or indirect force or threats to person or property, those are validly criminalized under this statute. Those are not protected speech. True threats, things like that, that's just not protected speech. But this by any manner clause sweeps so broadly that it does reach.
So help, sorry. I'm not following the by any manner argument because that's not the content of the speech. When we're talking about overbreath, we're looking at the content of the speech. And the content of the speech that is covered in the intimidating a witness statute is a witness who you expect to testify and you're trying to convince them through a variety of manners, including by any manner, to not testify fully, fairly, and truthfully.
And Your Honor, I would disagree with that characterization. I think that one of the problems with the statute is that it carries an assumption that whatever the words are conveyed is, it carries that assumption that you're asking them to untruthfully testify. And I think, again, there's all kinds of protected speech where you are allowed to say, I need you to testify truthfully to this. The state acknowledges in its brief that there is certainly a First Amendment right to persuade witnesses to testify truthfully.
But that's not prohibited by this statute.
And I guess, for me, if I might, just if you substituted the word manipulate instead of by any means, I mean, if he was attempting to manipulate her to testify untruthfully, I mean, to Justice Zahn's point, I mean, isn't that what the statute is getting at? It's not that it's trying to stop the manipulation.
Yes, I would agree. The goal is to stop the, you know, undermining of the justice system and how that works. I completely agree with that. I think some examples illustrate why this is overbroad in this by any manner context. First, I think a helpful example is we can think about a parent counseling their child against testifying against an abuser. That parent is deterring a witness from testifying freely, fully, and truthfully. But that's clearly, you know, protected speech. We can't allow that. And so I think this statute.
Why would that, if the intent was to prevent the child from testifying fully, fairly, and truthfully, why would that be constitutionally protected speech?
I think that there's at least a conflict, and there would be competing interests of this parent has the right to parent their child, and then this parent has maybe no rights to say whether their child has to testify in court. So I do think there's, you know, these butt up against each other. But again, I think, and again, the state responds to this hypothetical that this actually might fall under the statute as well, and they say, but a parent who tries to convince a prosecutor not to call the child as a witness at all clearly doesn't fall within the ambit of the statute. And I find that troubling because that leads us to the conclusion of who gets to decide that. And it opens it up to significant prosecutorial discretion.
But the defense could subpoena the child.
Sure, and I think another example is that defense subpoenaing a witness may also be deterring or harassing a witness. And so I think that's another...
That's not the language. I mean, how does subpoenaing someone constitute an attempt to prevent them from testifying fully, fairly, and truthfully?
I think, Your Honor, that would fall under this by any manner. If by any manner is serving a subpoena on a victim to, say, you know, gather their phone records, that could be seen to, depending on the person, as I'm being harassed and now I don't want to testify at all because I don't want to have to give this information over. So the by any manner really is just anything that's not a direct or indirect force or an overt threat to person or property.
Right, but I come back to the speech that is addressed in the statute is attempting to convince a witness to not testify fully, fairly, and truthfully. And so the defense subpoenas a witness in a case to have them come in and testify. And the witness says, I don't want the flack I'm going to get for this. What about, I mean, that's a witness determination. What about that is an act of the person who's subpoenaing, the defense attorney, what about that is trying to prevent someone from testifying fully, fairly, and truthfully?
I think that gets at this more specific intent requirement that I think the statute is missing. So right now, the operative plain language in the statute is willfully. So you only have to willfully do an act. You can willfully serve a subpoena on someone. But it ultimately depends on the intent of that person. Did they intend to, hopefully the victim maybe would say, I'm not going to go through with this, so I'm just going to stay home. It's about the intent. And I think Anderson does address this partially, but it doesn't go all the way. So Anderson was about jury instructions again and whether an error in a jury instruction was fundamental. But it does touch on the fact that the state needed to have proven that there was the intent to prevent the witness from testifying freely, fully, and truthfully. That additional element is now in the jury instructions. Idaho Criminal Jury Instruction 1266 is a completely separate and additional element that is not in the plain text of the statute. And so where that's a concern for me is that this court in Verska versus St. Alphonsus clarified that it's not the role of the court to modify or, you know, rewrite statutes. That's fully within the province of the legislature.
Let me ask you before you run out of time, we haven't gotten to the part of your overbreadth challenge where we talk about the cost-benefit analysis of protecting certain speech under the First Amendment versus some speech isn't worthy of protection. In that regard, I wanted to ask you, it seems to me that the purpose of the statute, one could say, is to protect witnesses, but I think there's a more overriding purpose of this statute. It's to protect the sanctity of the judicial process itself. Isn't that something that is worth preserving, to make sure that our trials become temples of truth and not subject to people being bribed or coerced or influenced or manipulated into preventing that truth from being figured out and determined?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's certainly a worthy goal, and I acknowledge that the statute partially achieves that by those first two methods. Again, I just think when the statute is broadly worded in this manner, the plain language of the statute as written is broad, and it sweeps up so much conduct that we just, I mean, again, it's not the role of this court to say whether that's an unsound policy or not. Again, those are decisions for the legislature. And I think it, again, is helpful to contrast this with the Manzanares case, which concerned a gang recruitment provision. In that case, this court said that was constitutional. It didn't offend First Amendment principles because the statute had a specific intent requirement that there had to be the specific intent to further the activity of the gang. And the court stated that that was a specific intent that was sufficient to narrow the reach of the statute. And the U.S. Supreme Court has noted that facial overbreadth isn't invoked when there is a limiting construction. And there just is not a limiting construction in this statute. I've cited to the Mercer case, the West case, and the Bayer case, where this court and the Court of Appeals have said this applies regardless of the effect on the witness, regardless of whether you're successful. It applies regardless of whether there's even a proceeding existing in that moment at all. And so there's not been any limiting constructions placed on it, but for the Anderson case, which again creates that conflict of, is this court's role to redline statutes or, you know, to strike them in whole and say the legislature, you know, you need to remedy this if this is still a policy goal we want to further in this state. And again, so this statute is just not drafted narrowly enough to survive that facial overbreadth because its expansive scope does not limit its application to unprotected speech.
I mean, it seems to me this court has implied mens rea elements in many statutes. And one of our canons of construction is we have an obligation to construe statutes in a way such that it effectuates constitutionality rather than to strike them down as being unconstitutional. And so, I mean, why isn't it perfectly proper for us to insert that mens rea element?
I think there's a challenge there, Your Honor, and I think just the authorities are conflicting. I agree. When the plain language of a statute lends itself to a construction that is limited, I think that's perfectly permissible for this court to do. But here, where we have, you know, the only mens rea element in the text of the statute is willfully, I think reading into that an additional specific intent element is going a little bit too far outside of the actual text of the statute. And so I would urge that this court should just strike the statute because the legislature has the province to create those laws. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Speech that is integral to criminal conduct is not protected by the First Amendment. It never has been. And reminders of this are easy to find. Just a few years ago, the Supreme Court said that speech intended to bring about a particular unlawful conduct is not protected speech and has no social value. Therefore, it is unprotected. So what does that mean? It means that offers to engage in illegal transactions are not protected speech. Perjury, not protected speech. Suborning of perjury, not protected speech. And it only takes the slightest lateral move from everything I just said to resolve this case. Idaho's witness intimidation statute prohibits speech that is integral to criminal conduct. It prohibits speech intended to intimidate a witness from fully, freely, and truthfully testifying at trial. That is why this statute is constitutional, both on its face and as applied to Mr. Orr. So I'm going to start with facial overbreadth. There's a two-part test here, and the first part of the test is whether the statute regulates constitutionally protected conduct. And that is where the analysis ends, because it does not. You have no right under the First Amendment to deter, harass, threaten, impede, influence, or intimidate a person from testifying fully, freely, and truthfully, just like you have no right to perjure yourself or suborn perjury. And Justice Mueller, you said the context here matters. And the state brought the receipts, and I'm going to share a few of the things that Mr. Orr said. I recognize that this is an institution of higher learning, so I won't quote all of the F-bombs, but I will just read through this because, Justice Mueller, you said it would be one thing if he said, well, just make sure to feed the dog, right? And that's not what he said. He said, you got to try to fix this. The only way you're going to try and fix this is to go to my prelim. I don't see there is any way of getting out of this unless you can try and do everything you can do. I need you to fix this, do everything you effing can. Are you going to revise your story or what? And then he says, discussing the length of prison term that he's facing, I'm telling you right now, it won't be 5 to 6 years. I will effing end it one way or another somehow. And I'll make it out one way or another, even if it's in a body bag. And then finally, the coup de grace in the end is he says, just hug my daughter and tell her that I love her. And I said, goodbye. So these are threats. This is clear intimidation. He's clearly trying to influence the victim in this case to change her story. So again, he's not saying make sure and feed the dog. It's akin to him saying, hey, say goodbye to the dog because I'm going to come home in a body bag if you don't revise your story at the prelim.
Well, context does matter. So let's change the context just a little bit. Let's imagine for a second we have a defendant incarcerated who's innocent. I know that might be harder for you to imagine than me. But let's assume we have an innocent
person. I can imagine that.
Okay, good.
I can imagine that either.
Let's imagine we have an innocent person in prison or in jail for a second. And the innocent person calls the witness that perjured themselves in making a false report and says these exact same words. An innocent person in prison calls the witness and says, you need to fix this. If you're not going to say what I want, don't say anything at all. I don't know if I'm going to make it out of here. I'll probably die while I'm there. And uses everything that this person used and dropped every F-bomb that this person dropped. Would we look at it the same way?
Well, you may not look at it the same way. But what we care about in that circumstance is how would the jury look at it? And this just gets to Justice Zahn's point. In this case, you have a defendant who says, look, my theory of the case is that I'm innocent. And apart from the constitutionality of the statute, he has that ability to take that claim to a jury, right? And again, if you have a prosecutor who's charging this thing, you know, the prosecutor has to decide from the get-go, is the story true or false? You know, is this person, is he actually innocent or not? Now, maybe the prosecutor disagrees and thinks he's guilty, so the prosecutor alleges you committed a crime. But then the case has to go before a magistrate, and that's another sort of guardrail in the system where the magistrate needs to find probable cause. Here the magistrate found probable cause and didn't find that Mr. Orr was innocent. And he hasn't challenged that determination. Okay. But at the end of the day, if a defendant has that theory, and if he says, look, what I did was actually not intimidating a witness. When I said I was coming home in a body bag, so you better fix your story, what I really meant was, it would be nice if you supplemented your report with some true statements. He can take that claim to a jury. Now, in this case, Mr. Orr had every opportunity to take that theory of the case to a jury. He only needed to convince one person that when he said, I'm coming home in a body bag unless you fix your story, what I really meant was I just need you to supplement your report with a true statement. He just needed to convince one person that that's a believable theory of the case, and he could have done that. But you know what? He didn't. He waived his right to do that because he pleaded guilty.
If the statute deters, though, an innocent person from being able to put up a full defense of their case, I'm just wondering if that's a cost that we're not prepared to pay. And I would remind you, too, that although it's easy to look at this guy and say, well, he's not the innocent person that you're using in your example, indeed, he's innocent until proven guilty. So at that moment when he made those comments, under the eyes of the law, he was an innocent person.
Sure, and that's fair and true. I will point out, too, he's been subsequently been convicted of that
because
other crime.
He entered a plea, yes, I understand that. But that I'm talking about the time the alleged crime took place. In the eyes of the law, he was an innocent person.
Sure, and so take this particular defendant off the table. It is possible for us to imagine a hypothetical person, an innocent person, not Mr. Orr, but someone who is innocent, whose speech might be chilled if they look at this statute. And I grant that, I fully concede that. However, the question isn't whether or not we can bend over backwards to imagine a scenario where one hypothetical person, their speech might be chilled. The question is whether the statute precludes a significant amount of constitutionally protected conduct. Now, the same argument could be made on the other side if we're talking about subornment of perjury. So we could say, well, isn't this statute unconstitutional? Because maybe there's someone out there who's actually innocent of the subornment of perjury. And maybe there's someone out there who, you know, they were just joking when they said what they said. For whatever reason, there's an innocent person out there, and we're worried about those people's speech being chilled. And again, you can imagine such hypotheticals, but that's not enough to reach the heavy burden to show a significant amount of conduct that's being precluded by the statute. So we just can't get there on this standard. Now, my friend also said that, you know, the state has prosecuted Mr. Orr solely on the words he uttered, and that that's a problem. Well, that can't be the standard, right? Because you have no right to perjure yourself, and that's based solely on the spoken word. You have no right to suborn perjury. That's based solely on spoken words. None of those statutes have an element that requires a threat or a true threat or any show of force. So that argument can't be correct. Now, my friend also gave a list of examples of things that don't fall within the scope of the statute in the state's view. And the first example was someone encouraging someone to testify truthfully. All right, let me make it clear. I have a large audience, so I just want to make very clear that if you encourage someone to testify truthfully, you have not violated this statute. It is not intimidating a witness to tell someone to testify and tell the truth. You're just not within the scope of the statute, so we're not worried about that. My friend also said that subpoenaing a witness to testify could potentially be viewed as a violation of the statute. No, if you're subpoenaing a witness to testify, you're wanting them to testify truthfully, right? Not the other way around. And then the final example was the parent and the child, and you have a parent, and the parent is saying to the child, child, I don't want you to testify. I do think that that's highly concerning, and I don't think that the First Amendment protects that kind of speech. I also don't know how this hypothetical even works, because I don't do family law, but I presume if your child, you know, if your five-year-old is subpoenaed to testify in court, I presume they serve it on you, the parent, right? Because you're the guardian of the child. And at the very least, you're the one that's going to be driving them to court, right? So it's, you're not going to sit down with your five-year-old and say, hey, I know you got to go to court today, but I think you should really not testify.
Change it to a 16 or 17-year-old.
Well, change it to a 16 or 17-year-old. Happy to do that. So I do not imagine a scenario where you have a 16 or 17-year-old in family law where we want to protect a parent's right to tell that 16 or 17-year-old, you should not testify truthfully. I still don't think there's any social value to that. If my wife says to me, I'm filing for a divorce, and she's tired of being the better appellate attorney in the family, and that's fair. I saw this coming. If I go to my 5-year-old son and I say, son, bad news for you, mom's pulling the plug on this whole thing, but I really want you at the next hearing to not tell the judge everything about dad, and I really don't want to have you tell the truth at the next child custody hearing, that would be terrible, right? That would be terrible if that sort of speech was permitted, and yet under my friend's view, that's exactly how the intimidation of a witness statute should work.
But let's go to the example that was given in briefing, which was a situation more akin to sexual abuse of a child, and the parent is concerned that if the child testifies, it will be traumatizing. And so the encouragement is, just don't testify.
So that's a trickier case. That's a bit of an edge case. And the reason why I say that is, if someone is compelled to testify by subpoena, it's really not something you can advise them to do. You can't tell them not to testify. And if you do tell them, I don't want you to testify, the necessary implication for just a regular witness, like your kid, is that they're going to have to testify truthfully, right? So that's a hard circumstance. But I think the answer is that, yes, if you are telling a witness that, hey, I'm trying to influence you into not testifying, I think the prosecutor would be within their rights to say, it looks like you're also trying to convince them not to testify truthfully. Now, one thing I'll say is that example does not apply if we're talking about a criminal defendant, right? Because a criminal defendant is uniquely situated among witnesses, and they can always say, no, I don't want to testify, right?
There's a distinction in Justice Meyer's hypothetical, isn't there? I mean, in terms of the parent saying, I'm really worried, like you've been struggling mental health-wise with what's happened to you. I don't think it's a good idea for you to relive this. Tell the prosecutor you don't want to testify. That's different than you've been subpoenaed and I think you should just not show up. Or you've been subpoenaed and why don't you go to Florida and stay with grandma, because if you're not here, you can't testify.
Well, I think it is different, but that's because those are different facts and that drives a different analysis. So if the person hasn't been subpoenaed at all, then I think the parent has a lot more latitude to say, let's talk to the prosecutor. Let's see if the prosecutor even wants to subpoena you as a witness to begin with. And if the prosecutor hasn't made up his or her mind yet and hasn't made that call, then I don't think we're getting close to the conduct that we're talking about in this statute. So I agree. Analysis is different, but it's only different because I think the facts are sufficiently different in that case. Okay. I do want to turn to as applied. I welcome the court's questions on that, especially if you have any questions about whether or not the state waived or forfeited anything. And if you don't have a question on that, I'll just skip ahead right to the merits. The merits here are easy. It's the exact same argument as above, right? So in order to show that a statute is unconstitutional as applied, the party challenging the constitutionality of the statute must demonstrate that as applied to their conduct, it's unconstitutional. But a necessary precondition of doing that is showing that the statute infringes upon his or her freedom of speech protected by the First Amendment. The speech that we're talking about, just like perjury, just like suborning of perjury, is not protected by the First Amendment to begin with. So the as-applied challenge will fail there too. Okay, I have a lot of time left on the board. I welcome this court's questions.
I have a question about
absolutely.
Footnote 8 and the jury instruction. And the appellant's position that our jury instruction is wrong and that we ought to revise it.
I don't know that the jury instruction is wrong. I confess I don't fully, let me put it this way. I don't really have a dog in the fight on whether or not this court should revise the jury instruction, because I don't think it affects the outcome of this case at all. But someone in our office is on the jury instruction committee, so we will report back to you. Got that, guys? All right. Any other questions I would welcome from this court before I sort of segue into a final point here? Okay, here's the final point. If this court agrees that spoken words can only be criminalized if they amount to true threats or shows of force, and if this court takes the invitation and excises that by any manner language out of the statute, well, what happens? It would open the floodgates to allowing intimidating and influencing witness testimony, just as long as you don't threaten them, right? As long as you ask nicely, or as long as you just intimidate them, or as long as, hey, you could even threaten them, just make sure it's not a true threat.
Or bribe them.
Or, hey, bribe away. Why not? It's all of that would be allowed, right? You just can't have a true threat. You just can't have a show of force. And now I submit that that would be bad. We don't want to do that. But that's just the first domino to fall, right? Because if my friend is right that it doesn't just apply to witness intimidation, but we're talking about any spoken words that aren't true threats, and the First Amendment covers all of that, well, then everything else is up for striking down, right? So you could go through the Idaho Code. You could pick any statute you want. You could start with child enticement, right? 1815.09. Child enticement doesn't require a true threat. It doesn't require a show of force. It just requires that you persuade a child to come with you, you know, into your van and because you have puppies or whatever. That's illegal, by the way. That's a misdemeanor. But under my friend's view, that is actually protected by the First Amendment. So that would have to be struck down too. Bribery statutes, perjury statutes, criminal conspiracy, fraud, all of these things would have to be unconstitutional under my friend's view if this court agrees with that view. Well, there is an easier path. This court should conclude that speech that is integral to criminal conduct is not protected by the First Amendment. And I would ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
5 minutes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I have a few points in rebuttal. First, I did review the Idaho Code. There are several provisions in the Idaho Code that contain severability provisions. This statute is not one of them. For example, indecency and obscenity statutes have a severability code. Additionally, the telephone harassment statute, somewhat analogous here, includes a specific intent element, something this statute is lacking. I want to highlight Justice Mueller's point as well, that this deters innocent people from fully and freely, zealously defending their case. Like I pointed out earlier, on the first phone call, Mr. Orr had no idea what the charging language was. He had not been arraigned yet. There's a lot of information he doesn't even know. This is chilling speech. And it's not just one person being chilled. The hypotheticals discussed are real and substantial interactions that do happen every day, and the statute does reach those examples. I also want to talk about why this is not criminal. This is not speech integral to criminal conduct. First, I agree that speech integral to criminal conduct is not protected speech. I don't think this court needs to hold that. That's already well established. This is not speech intended to bring about a particular unlawful act when you look at the plain language of the statute. It again comes back to this specific intent element that is not present in the plain language. And again, it also relies on the assumption that whatever the speaker is saying is trying to elicit untruthful testimony versus additional truthful testimony. I think when we talk about that, it sort of gets us into the realm of a content-based restriction. And as we know, those are presumptively invalid. And so I think if it's the state's position that it's just up to the prosecutor, again, to determine whether this person, we think, an innocent person, is trying to manipulate someone, then maybe they are charged and that speech is chilled. So again, it relies on that assumption that a testimony being elicited is supposedly untruthful.
I don't understand your content-based analysis in light of the fact that the Supreme Court's very clearly said that speech which is part of the crime itself, is not protected.
Yes, I agree. And content-based versus content-neutral is not really the central issue here, but I highlight it to point out that it is opening this up to such broad prosecutorial discretion. The United States Supreme Court in U.S. versus Stevens, they specifically rejected the government's contention that it would use the statute responsibly. They said we would not uphold an unconstitutional statute by the promise of the government to, you know, use it responsibly. And so I think we can't leave this hanging out there for that.
I realize this isn't the first safeguard you would look to, but isn't the jury also a safeguard in these cases? If this case had proceeded to jury, I can imagine your client could have attempted to make a pretty persuasive argument attributing innocent motives to all the things he said, as you did when you began your presentation today.
Yes, I agree. I agree that, you know, there's certainly much more information we could have had, or, you know, the jury, that would be in the jury's province. We just don't have that specifically presented here. And finally, I just want to highlight that Mr. Orr did not say, if you don't revise your story, I'm coming home in a body bag. His statements were not, if you do this, then this. He did not link that conduct. And so I do take issue with the characterization of that in that aspect. And if there are no further questions, Mr. Orr asked this court to declare Section 18-2604 unconstitutionally overbroad and reverse the district court's order denying his motion to dismiss. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This matter is under advisement. We'll render a decision in due course and be in recess until 11:15.
All right, please.